Hey everybody, this is the first episode of the Welcome To podcast. I'm your host, Zach Vega. This is presented by the Land Information Access Association. For those of you who don't know about LIA, as we go by, we are a nonprofit based out of Traverse City. We do community development projects where, we try to educate local jurisdictions on how to implement best practices that we do the research on and get grant funding through. So I'm a, for this first episode, I'd like to give a little bit of background about myself so you know where I'm coming from. I'm a community planner with LIA. I work on a variety of community planning projects. I do master plan updates. We're working on one in Port Austin right now. LIA really specializes in a lot of community resilience. We work with Coastal Zone Management, NOAA, Eagle, to plan for Michigan's coast, protecting them, best practices, all of that fun stuff. We do a lot of work with trails, our Trail Town projects, how to connect trails to the local economy, get people off the trail downtown. And forgive my voice today, it won't always be this stuffy. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, but I wanted to make sure that I get this first episode out to you guys because it's a little time sensitive. Today's episode is with Mary Riley and Brad Newman. They are MSU Extension land use educators. This was at the MAP conference. We talked about the new recreational marijuana law coming through and the gaps that MSU Extension is seeing in communities preparing for that legislation and what ordinances they really need to get on and pass as soon as possible. This episode's coming out a little later than we would have liked it to. It takes a while to edit these, so we're not getting it out at a time that was really great for people to prepare for the ordinance for that November 1st deadline. But nonetheless, it's good information to know, and so hopefully you find that entertaining. And then the conversation switches over to Brad Newman. Brad is based out of Marquette, up in the UP. And he does a lot of work on climate change and more specifically the health impacts that are they're finding from the research that they're doing in terms of, air quality, pollutants getting into the local water that's affecting, beach quality, river quality, and then invasive species, all those things that people sometimes overlook when they think about the climate change impacts. So it was, I really appreciate the time that they took out of their incredibly busy MAP conference. They were teaching the citizen planner curriculum the entire time. So it was really nice of them to take the time to do the podcast episode with me and record that first episode. So going back to why we're doing this podcast, there's a couple reasons. The first is that Michigan, it's really important to me. It's a state that raised me, and I want to see, every community in the state getting better, improving, and implementing best practices so that it's a sustainable and vibrant state. And I had the opportunity at MSU. I'm a recent grad student graduate. I had the opportunity to work with a lot of great researchers, a lot of people on the, and a lot of not just researchers, but people working on the front lines and implementing these ideas in communities around Michigan. And it was such a great opportunity for me to learn from these people firsthand. And I use a lot of their teachings in my work today. So there was part of it where I wanted to keep in touch with these people and expand my knowledge base throughout my career. And these are busy people, so it's hard for me to just say, hey, can I call you for an hour and talk on the phone about these best practices? I thought a better approach to that would be I talk to these people and we record it and we get this information out to a wider audience so that people around the state know what the newest practices are. They know what the research is showing us, what the new data is teaching us about ideas like housing and climate change and transportation and land use and neighborhood development, all of these ideas that I think are incredibly important and interesting. We want to be able to share those to people around the state from the people who are the upper echelon of researching these ideas. So With that being said, it's a little bit, maybe it's a little selfish on my part. I want to keep getting educated, and I want these people to keep talking to me about these ideas. But I also want to make sure that whether you're a planner around the state, whether you're a local official, maybe you're a planning commissioner, maybe you run a nonprofit yourself, maybe you're a concerned neighbor, somebody who's just interested in understanding how local government works, how projects are implemented, why streetscapes are redesigned a certain way, basically just how things work locally and what's going on around the state. I think that our state becomes better when we share these ideas and we collaborate on these innovative solutions to solving the problems that are presenting themselves globally, regionally, and around the state. And so we want this podcast, Welcome to be a resource for people. So we'll present all of these ideas with the people that are kind enough to take the time to talk to me. And we also welcome you to interact with the podcast. And so me being a recent graduate, really a new planner in the field, I'm still learning. I don't have all the answers, and I don't think anyone has all the answers. Some people certainly have more than I do. I'm new. So I'm still learning, and we all are. So if you have any questions, if there's anything local government-wise or land use-wise, especially in terms of planning, and you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us, and we'll try to find those answers, because it's good information for me, and it's probably a question that other people have too. So if you have any questions related to anything that you hear in the podcast or anything in general, maybe there's somebody that you would like to listen to on the podcast that you think I should reach out to have on for an episode, go ahead and email me at zvega@liaa.org. So that's zvega@liaa.org. And we'll do our best to get you the answers that you're looking for. Again, trying to use this podcast, Welcome To, as a resource for people around the state. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. This first episode, again, with Mary Riley and Brad Newman, MSU Land Use Extension Educators. MSU Extension Land Use Educators, taking the time with me at the MAP Conference. This was recorded, I believe, September 26th. Thanks, guys.
You go first. Ladies first.
Brad, this morning, I'm sure he's tired because he just took a boat to Wisconsin and now he's back. And Mary and him have been teaching American Citizen Planner all day. So big thank you to them for taking the time to talk about the issues that we think people will care about around the state and want to hear about as MSU Extension educators. They are more than qualified to talk about this stuff. So we're going to talk about a few topics and then we're going to go have some fun because we're at the MAP conference. So we don't want to spend too much time talking about things that we've been learning about all day. But for the time being, I think we wanted to talk about the new marijuana legislation and then also climate change, which is interesting because Brad is up in Marquette. So some fun storms that you guys have had up there recently. But let's start talking about the recreational marijuana legislation. Mary, what questions have you been getting from communities, and what are the issues that you're seeing as this November deadline comes up, and how are you helping communities plan for this new legislation?
So what's interesting in Michigan right now is we have 1,773 municipalities, and of them, about 800, probably a little more now, maybe 815 or 20, it climbs every day, but they have opted out. So that leaves 900 and change that are opted in. And of those, we're not really sure how many have affirmatively opted in. You know, yeah, for sure, we're all on board. We want recreational marijuana facilities. Maybe let's say it's 200 on the high end, because there's about 120, 130, 50 communities that have opted into medical. So that leaves, if you do the math, about 700 or so communities that we just don't know, right?
And why are communities opting out?
It's different reasons. Some are opting out maybe to reflect the voting population, how the community voted on Proposal 1 in November. Some communities are opting out as a placeholder because the laws are relatively unclear in terms of zoning, planning, ordinance writing. There's a lot of gray areas in the law. So some are opting out as a placeholder, waiting for the dust to settle. Maybe in a year or two they'll opt in once things get a little bit clearer. And then there's a whole bunch of communities, I think, that might just be like, it's not going to happen here, or maybe they don't have staff, or they're living under a rock or something, you know. It's unclear, but that's kind of the concern, is we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Michigan communities that might be faced with marijuana in their communities that they don't want, but they are opted in automatically.
So hypothetically, if a community hasn't adopted an ordinance by the November timeline, what does that leave them susceptible to? Is it just unlimited facilities that can be placed in the agricultural and industrially zoned areas of their community? What happens?
That's a good question. And they could be subject to any one of the licenses that LARA might issue. For a provisioning center or a growing operation or a micro business or a designated consumption establishment. When you add them all up, there's about 9 different licenses. And so if this person applies to the Marijuana Regulatory Agency within LARA and they meet all of those requirements, then LARA has to issue them a license if that community is not opted out. So then they'll be knocking on the door of the community with a license, and that community should be putting them somewhere because they have opted in, right, without opting out. So communities, you know, typically there's some 30 days or some amount of time where after you adopt an ordinance, let's say they choose to opt out, or they're just hearing this now and panicking. Mm-hmm. There's some amount of time you have to wait after publication or whatever for an ordinance to become effective. So that needs to be effective by November 1st. So that means they have really right. got to do some work if they mean to opt out.
I went to the recreational marijuana, the general law session this week, and I could see a lot of wide eyes in the audience when they found out that it has to be effective by that time, and mm-hmm. that's usually 30 days. And so when you look at November 1st, and we're recording this today on September 26th,
right.
It's like, okay, we better
get busy.
Yeah, we should probably not be at this conference right now. We should probably be home. So what are communities that are opting in? Is there a model ordinance that they're using to limit the types of facilities and the numbers and where they can go, or is that more difficult to accomplish right now?
I don't know of a model ordinance. A lot of communities are grappling with some of the details regarding if and how to restrict the number of licenses or the type of licenses, because this new law, Proposal 1, only talks about limiting the number of licenses. It doesn't reference type specifically. The emergency rules have some stopgaps in them to make sure that the local community is agreeing with whatever the ordinances are. That LARA knows what those local ordinances are and they're complying with them. But there's no model ordinance because it's pretty gray. And so it's a matter of really working with your attorney and figuring out what those comfort levels are in the community for whatever you're looking to do. But one of the interesting things is if you are attempting to limit the number of facilities, you have to have a competitive process. And that's really antithetical to the zoning process because it all tries to be legal or even playing field, right? Due process. Everyone gets treated the same. So having this competitive process, it's really, really important to work with an attorney on that so you don't get into trouble.
Yeah, and so that's a question I had during the general law session is when they say you have to have a competitive process, what exactly does that mean? And obviously, go to your attorney about that, but what does that generally mean?
Some different examples. Some communities might do first come, first serve, which is not really a competitive process. Some communities might try to do a merit-based process. Maybe they have certain points or, I don't know, you know, if you hire certain people in the community, maybe with some equity planning, design elements or location, maybe there's more merit for those applications. Other communities are struggling with the number of applicants. In order to level the playing field, they're pulling the applicant out of a hat, so it's completely random. You know, as long as they've met all the requirements. So So the community has to establish the requirements by which an applicant meets the standards of their local ordinance. So once that is done, some communities are just doing kind of a lottery system. But that's not without fault also or without issue.
So what do you think the future of zoning looks like with recreational marijuana company? And do you think that... do you think there's a possibility that they're going to do overlay districts out here in this B1, but not over here in this B1 because we don't want it on the main corridor, things like that?
Yeah, Manistee, City of Manistee and City of Muskegon have overlay districts for marijuana. And so what they've essentially done is said is in these particular zones, any one of the licenses can exist. And so they've both looked at either areas that really need redevelopment and investment or areas that maybe have old industrial buildings. Maybe some of that infrastructure is there and the buildings just need to be repurposed. So that is happening. And then other communities are just doing the standard zoning.
And are there any communities that you've seen that, I know we talked about there's not really a model ordinance right now, but are there any model communities that have kind of taken the lead on what we could call a best practice at this time?
I couldn't really say. I think the jury's still out on what might make a model ordinance or a model practice. It's because none of this has hit the road, you know. The rubber hasn't hit the road yet on how these work. So I can't give you an answer to that. But.
So it seems like there's a lot more pandemonium around the recreational compared to the medical in the implementation part of it. Why?
Well, that's a strong word, Zach.
Well, it seems like there's a little more panic, but I think that's probably because of how the laws differ, the recreational from the medical.
Yeah, what we learned in the session yesterday with Catherine Kaufman was that the MTA and MAP and a number of MML were all at the table when they were writing the Facilities Licensing Act, the MMFLA, in 2016. And so that act kind of favors the municipalities a little bit. You'll note that act is you automatically opted out. You know, if you don't do anything, you're opted out. Catherine was very open about this law was written by the marijuana industry, and so it tends to favor the marijuana industry. But the issue there is that some of it is just so unclear to municipalities that they might be opting out just because it's unclear. So I don't know if it's a benefit. I'm sure it's a benefit in some ways, but maybe not others, that it's kind of balanced toward the marijuana industry.
And so the ambiguity, it sort of supports, because I know when we were talking in the session yesterday, they were saying for the medicinal marijuana, if you didn't adopt an ordinance, you were automatically opted out?
No.
Is that wrong?
If you're opted in. If you don't do anything.
No, for the for medicinal.
Oh, medicinal.
When that one came out.
Right.
You were opted out.
Right.
But for this one, you're opted in.
Correct.
Which has put in a lot of communities, you know, you've got day-to-day operations you have to do. Maybe you have to do some zoning administration. You're the only municipal staff member in the planning department in a small township somewhere. And you just don't have time to follow legislation that's going through the gambit all the time. Have you gotten a lot of calls from your counties about what's going on?
I mean, not really. We've gotten, MSU Extension has done a podcast that started in May, I think. So we've rolled out a webinar. Sorry, not a podcast. Thanks, Brad. Been trying to kind of hit these different aspects of this law as things are coming out. Like when the emergency rules came out, Brad Newman did this amazing program on, you know, some of the ordinance language and things like that. We just had one on revenue, and because a lot of communities have questions about that, you know, how much money is going to come back to our communities, and not a lot is really known around that. Communities are needing a little bit of help discerning what the vote meant of the public. Did they mean it, let's say they voted in favor of it, 60-40. Did they mean to vote to decriminalize marijuana, or did they mean to have those facilities in their community? And so kind of what we're finding out is the yes vote didn't necessarily mean yes here. It meant some different things. So communities are needing a little help with facilitating a discussion on where do you want to go? because sometimes just looking at the vote isn't, it's not a binary, you know, they voted yes, we will vote yes. So
right, it could mean we voted yes, we'd like to see maybe three facilities to support our downtown economy or something like that, or in a, you know, maybe somewhere that needs to be redeveloped, but we don't want it on every street corner, potentially.
Yeah, or we voted yes because somebody who gets caught with a little bit of marijuana shouldn't go to jail. Or so many people are smoking marijuana now through medical, or the medical aspect of it has helped to maybe familiarize more people with it, or for whatever reason, but they didn't necessarily see like a local connection.
Right. And when I was living in Lansing with the, there were a lot of medicinal shops there. And it seems like the big issue with not limiting it is that if you oversaturate the market and they're over competitive, and then you end up having a lot of potentially abandoned buildings in your community because there just aren't enough people to buy that much medicinal marijuana in Lansing at that time. So
yeah,
I could see that being another reason that you would want to limit these in your community.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it seems like it's not clear if and how you can do that.
Right.
So
right. Yep.
An ongoing issue.
Yeah, it's an ongoing issue.
Yeah. What? Do you see any other potential issues that could come up from this?
In some of the communities that I've worked in, there's a lot of questions around enforcement. And so if a community does allow these in the community, or, you know, in their community, let's say a dispensary or a grow operation or any of the licensures, some communities are still thinking, well, it's still illegal in the federal level. So are the federal government going to come in here and bust us, or are we going to be liable for allowing this? And I mean, the answer's not really, you know, the federal government hasn't been very active in marijuana enforcement for some time. There's confusion, though, about even like our local police department. What can they do? Because it's legalized. And so then what falls on the city and what really can be inspected by the locals versus LARA, the marijuana regulatory agency. So there's just some questions about, you know, how is that really going to work? Plus, you still have the caregiver law, and people can grow it in their own homes. And legally now, you know, you could have up to 12 plants in your home. So just kind of the enforcement. And if we do or we don't, who's watching for what? So that's a concern.
And then can you also break down the different types of facilities that go into ordinances, and for people who don't know?
Sure. There's three different levels of growers. Class A, B, and C. A is the smallest, B, and then C is the largest. And the plant, there's the same terminology for the medical marijuana, but the plant numbers are different. Then there's a new category called a micro business in the recreational law, and I think you can grow up to 150 plants, but you can be vertically integrated as a processor and a grower, or processor, grower, and retailer. All of the three. That's part of the micro business. Secure transporter, processing facility, safety compliance facility. The safety compliance facility is responsible for testing the marijuana to determine the potencies and then labeling it properly so people know what they're buying. Then there's four new categories, or three or four, that were birthed out of the emergency rules. And those are designated consumption establishment, which would be similar somewhat to a bar, not in a bar, but similar to a bar where people can get together and, you know, smoke marijuana or ingest it in whatever fashion, with rules around that. There's a marijuana event organizer. If you want to organize events, you have to be licensed. And then marijuana events. Oh, and an excess grower. So that's if you have a Class C license, I think three Class C licenses, you can be an excess grower on top of that.
Okay, and so I know in the, sorry if we already talked about this, but I know in the medical marijuana, they had the ability to limit the number of each type. For the new law, can they only limit the total number of facilities, or can you limit the number of each type of facility?
Zach, if I knew the answer to that question... I'll take a shot at it, and then I'm going to give it to you.
So that goes back to the point that the law is not very clear.
Yeah, so the law says you can limit the number of facilities. It does not not say type. But in the emergency rules, it's very clear that the local clerk has to attest or do this attestation that whatever the license is that they're applying for, it meets the local ordinances. So I think it's an attempt to say if a community has tried to limit the types of ordinance, say they just want growers, that's it. There's sort of an attempt to try to back that up. That doesn't protect the community maybe from a lawsuit from somebody who wants a provisioning center where they only allow growers in that community. We're not really sure who would take that next step if, you know, businesses would sue a municipality to do that. But that's kind of the concern. That's the risk.
Right. Yeah, it seems like they're open to a lot of potential litigation if they choose to opt in, and this with the language being so unclear at this point that, like you said, if you're an agricultural community and you only want to have growers because, you know, that goes along with your current land uses and it makes sense that, you know, if you've got one crop here, makes sense to just add another crop here, but maybe you don't want to have people like potentially marijuana tourists coming into your community or just generally the people in your community don't want those types of businesses. It's unclear that you can differentiate between those two to have one but not the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not an attorney, so I think that in the next year or two, the dust will probably settle. Yeah, we are not attorneys.
Brad, are you having any work on this? Brad's up in Marquette, so we can get a UP perspective here. What are the sentiments in the UP, that other place?
Well, you know, the one thing I was thinking about as Mary was talking about the different license types and whether or not a community can limit licenses by type, I had the opportunity to talk to some gentlemen that are about to open a provisioning center under the Medical Facilities Licensing Act, and they're really concerned about supply of their product because they can't retail anything from a caregiver, right, under the 2008 Medical Marijuana Act. They can only retail marijuana that's been grown in a commercial grow facility authorized under the 2016 legislation. And apparently, you know, they were saying this is a limit in the marketplace right now. And that's one reason that the Marijuana Regulatory Agency added this other type of grower. You know, if a community's attempting to go with one facility over another, I think the market is maybe going to equalize some of this. You know, in talking to these gentlemen, a provisioning center, as rigorous as that is to get permitted in their minds, is a way easier venture in this industry than it is to be a grower. As technical and just difficult it is to be a grower of marijuana these days, of, you know, the quality that is required of the marketplace, it's a much more daunting, risky pursuit to be a grower. So it seems like in the Medical Facilities Licensing Act, you know, maybe there's more people going for this provisioning center license. And, you know, as these two laws sort of blend together over time, because we know the MRA is working on, you know, coming out with final rules for adult use or recreational marijuana, they're simultaneously reviewing the administrative rules from the Medical Marijuana Facilities Licensing Act. So I think we're going to see these things over time kind of blending together. We already know they've talked about different licenses between the two pieces of law being considered sort of equivalent licenses. In other words, if you've been licensed as a provisioning center and the municipality also authorizes adult use marijuana, then naturally you can, you know, evolve. You need to get another license, but you can become a retailer under the, you know, voter initiated law for November. So, you know, started talking about the number of licenses in the community, you know, I think we'll see some changes as sort of the marketplace establishes itself and things sort of unfold. You know, this topic is going to be unfolding for a long time. The 2008 Michigan Medical Marijuana Act, we see court cases still in flux now, you know, more than 10 years later, you know, that voter initiated law is still trying to be sorted out. And so we've got a more complex voter initiated law with Proposal 1 from last year, and we're probably going to have another, you know, 10 years of unfolding case law.
Right. I think, like you said, unfolding case law, and then going back to what you said about the market sort of having a role in this, I think that's another interesting point because it's, you know, because this is a new industry in Michigan and really in the United States as a whole. When companies open, they sort of know how many, like when Walmart opens, they know how many people, a certain size store, what population, a community, when they're going into it, how many people that they can service. Whereas marijuana, we really don't know. When communities are trying to regulate this and limit the number of types of facilities and kind of guess how many facilities they should have of each type, it's really just a guessing game because they don't know how many the market will support or how many, if you allow 30, maybe that's too many. And now you've got an oversaturated market where you might have abandoned buildings in the future that, you know, you're leaving your downtown at risk of a quick turnover of restaurants that have been there for a long time. So it seems like that's going to be another issue with that as well.
You know, you asked about what's going on in the UP. The city of Marquette is having a conversation about recreational marijuana. They didn't do anything on medical marijuana, never authorized those facility types. And their strategy right now is just to focus on adult use. And at a city commission meeting, one commissioner suggested, you know, I don't think we should set any number of maximum facilities in the community. We should just let it unfold. And that sentiment sort of, you know, permeated the rest of the commission. And that's kind of how they let it settle. They're planning to move forward to allow adult use facilities. And they've kind of decided we're not going to try to set a cap. So it'll be, yeah, like you said, and I think that all is part of this new world.
I was in a community and they had talked about limiting the number to one. And then there was a
Just one facility.
Okay. You know, one dispensary, and this was an area that was geographically isolated from other dispensaries, and so one of the persons who was in the market said, "You can't have one. You really need to have two or three." So we're competing against each other, you know. And so I thought that was an interesting point for communities that are really looking to limit, you know, especially if you're the only game in town for a 1 hour drive, a 2 hour drive, a 3 hour drive, you know, that kind of thing. It might be a better option to have more than one, you know, two or three, at least from the consumer side.
Right, and that's
to have some choice.
And that's
not 20.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
you
20.
You lived in Lansing for so long that I there was caregiver dispensaries,
yeah.
I think.
And it was clearly too many, but that's not the fault of Lansing because we just don't know what is too many. We don't know what is too few to, if it's too few to, that it's stifling competition, or if it's too many that you're leaving your local economy vulnerable to whims in the market or quick changes in the marketplace. So I mean, in local markets, it's important to have some regulation. It can't just be the Wild West because, like I was talking about, you leave yourself susceptible to a quickly turning over downtown or a retail district with no real stability. But you also, so that's why you want to limit it, but also you want to let the market do its thing and have that competition to let it play out naturally too. So it's striking that balance, and we don't have a lot of case studies to know what that balance is because it's such a new, especially in Michigan, new phenomenon.
From what I understand, in Oregon, there was an issue with kind of an oversaturated market, and the pricing of the marijuana started at a higher level. I don't want to put numbers on it, but then it fell to such a low level that it wasn't even covering the cost of growing the marijuana. So I think that's more like a statewide policy level of how much is too much in terms of licenses and stuff.
So I guess we'll leave this topic off with the notion that we're not lawyers. Check with your municipal attorney to make sure that you're doing everything by the books and that you've got all the correct information. And we'll likely be revisiting this as November passes by, and hopefully we can regroup and see how communities across Michigan are dealing with this. But in the meantime, we're going to switch over to climate change. And Brad, what does that mean to you and your work?
Well, one thing that we do at Extension is, of course, share the latest science and findings of sort of the academic world and where those things are important to local communities. It's our job to convey that information and help communities in understanding that, translating that information into local policy. And, you know, this is a topic where here we are this week in New York City. You know, the UN has convened and there's been some conversation about climate change. And there has been another new report on warming oceans, new research about ocean temperatures rising. And so, you know, I think it's incumbent upon our organization to continue to talk about this topic in all communities. And so we've had some projects, Extension in partnership with the MSU School of Planning, Design, and Construction, where we have been working with communities in Marquette County, talking about not just climate change and the science and what the particular impacts might be to a community in the UP, but then translating those expected impacts to the human population, right? So we're talking about planning and zoning. We're talking about doing things in the name of health, safety, and welfare. And so this particular project that also involves the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is trying to make that sort of full circle connection. It's a referred to as a climate health pathway. And, you know, as one example, one of the identified issues for the upper Midwest is increasing extreme precipitation events. And if you combine those types of events that have the effect of flushing pollutants, nutrients into waterways, you combine that with increasing water temperatures of our Great Lakes, and you have situations where nutrient material adding to the water, you know, is allowed to incubate and do its thing in nearshore waters where people like to swim and cause a potential health effect. So that's just one example of this climate health pathway where we have a climate driver, a couple of drivers in this case, warmer temperatures, more storm events that unleash large amounts of water that cause major flashing. That means, you know, large volumes of storm water that enter waterways. And so anyway, this particular project working with communities in Marquette is trying to understand those issues for that community and then come up with a number of strategies that communities might employ. So to kind of complete that example, you know, how might we disrupt that climate health pathway? We might do that by having more green stormwater infrastructure in place in developments, using that technique with municipal infrastructure more often. Instead of our legacy of moving water as fast as we can through pipes and ditches and basins to flush it, you know, we might take a different approach now, knowing that we want to capture that water, slow it down, let it absorb, and try to get rid of more of that nutrient material that with warmer water temperatures could exacerbate a public health issue.
So I have three questions on that, and we can hopefully work through them before we go have our fun. What, I know you mentioned the issue with pollutants getting to water systems and potentially causing hazards for people who are, you know, swimming in our Great Lakes or the many lakes that we have, waterways. So what are the negative impacts of the climate change that we're seeing in terms of Michigan's experience? So I think a lot of people are familiar with rising oceans, but I don't think a lot of people are familiar with climate impacts on Michigan's ecosystems. The second question is that is how are we planning to deal with that? And then third, if you're a planner who's concerned about these things, what experience have you had, what positive experience have you had with engaging people on these issues?
You are quickly a professional newsman, Zach. So for your first podcast, this is a great set of questions. So first, you know, some of the Michigan climate concerns. I mentioned the more frequent significant precipitation events. That's a forecasted thing that more precipitation is expected to come in singular events as opposed to being spread out throughout the year. And with that could be longer periods of drought. So we could have, you know, more intense rainstorms that cause all kinds of erosion and damage like we saw in Houghton in June of 2018, this Father's Day flood that caused over $100 million in public infrastructure damage, followed by a prolonged period of drought. And that, of course, can, you know, raise concerns for, you know, agriculture, for forestry, for wildfire threat, all kinds of things. So certainly some water-related issues. Also on that element, you know, what does that mean for Great Lakes levels? Right now, Great Lakes, they're at long-time highs, and communities have all kinds of infrastructure impacts. I was in Menominee, Michigan last night, and, you know, the municipal dock in places, it's underwater, it's unusable, they can't rent those slips. That's a rather insignificant municipal infrastructure issue, but with those high waters, you know, come impacts to public infrastructure, roadways, private property, and that's certainly something that all communities should be concerned about. But to my knowledge, the science is unclear whether high Great Lakes levels are to be expected. I think the consensus is that there's going to be just a variety or a fluctuation in sort of Great Lakes levels. So, you know, it was only a few years ago that we saw levels for some lakes like Michigan and Lake Huron at record lows. And so right. In this crazy short period of time, we're at a high. So,
yeah, I'll point out real quick for people who are listening who don't know the dynamics of the Great Lakes. Take a look at Guy Meadows' work at Michigan Tech University. He's been studying this forever, since the 70s or 80s. Basically, the Great Lakes, they fluctuate every 10 to 15 years. So you'll have periods where the water is, so how the ocean fluctuates twice a day, the Great Lakes are every 10 to 15 years. So you'll have periods where the water is really far out. We see a lot of development at that time. And then when that water comes back, now you've got a lot of community infrastructure that's not at risk. So understanding those coastal dynamics is a really big part of being resilient, especially now that the changing waters now have a greater effect because of these heavier storms that go along with them now.
Yeah. Got a call a few weeks ago from a property owner asking about, you know, they were seeking my wisdom on whether or not to develop a lake property for a retirement home on Lake Michigan. And, you know, my crystal ball is not so clear. And it's really a $1 million question for this individual, exactly where they might site their home on the property. And, I think people just need to be aware of that and be able to plan for that extreme, you know, variations. Real quick, you know, two other kind of climate-related concerns I think that public health officials have in Michigan. One to mention is heat and air quality. Now, in the UP, that's maybe not going to be as much of an issue, but Southeast Michigan or Southwest Michigan, where we sit here today, you know, 100-degree days and, you know, cooling, that can be a concern. And we're not Arizona or New Mexico, but still some of those warm temperatures. And here on this side of the state, I know that you can have some air quality concerns as well, as some of that hot air stacks up on the Lake Michigan shoreline and can cause some problems for people that already have, say, a health issue, asthma or the elderly. And that's another thing to point out. You know, here we're at the conference talking about equity in our planning principles. And climate change impacts is one of those things that impacts the vulnerable population much more than, say, anyone that has the means to get out of the way or to, you know, take the precautionary measures to protect themselves. So really, if we're going to be talking about equity in our communities, this is an issue that is squarely part of the conversation. Elderly that might be more susceptible to those heat waves, children that could not be as prepared in the event of a flooding issue. And so it is a broad equity concern for sure.
Right. And one of the ways that I see that play out in plans is, or what Leah typically recommends and that we put into a lot of plans, is first you want to identify your vulnerable population. So where are your low-income people? Where are the elderly populations? People who typically couldn't deal with a prolonged period of really hot weather, and then locate maybe like a cooling center in that neighborhood, and then let people know about it so that they, you know, if they can't afford to have central air throughout the summer, they have a place to go where they don't have to deal with these stressors that are coming from climate change. That's just one example. There's a lot of things that people can be doing, but we don't have time to cover all of those today.
So I think that was one of your questions. What should planners be doing? I think in Michigan we're sort of behind on this topic. Now, granted, the impacts that we're expected to experience as a region are relatively minor, I guess I'll say, compared to, say, communities in the Southwest or on either the coasts that might be dealing with sea level rise. But what some experts have talked about is the upper Midwest being ripe for receiving climate refugees. So we have our own impacts, which we've both identified here, but then think about dealing with these impacts and potential impacts on human health as the population continues to grow. If we're receiving more people because the impacts we're experiencing are relatively less, well, that's a whole nother challenge that is squarely within the planner's realm of how to deal with this overtime gradual growth in population, which is not unrealistic.
So when you're working with people in Marquette, working with communities as an extension educator, what strategies have you used? How are you approaching these conversations to get the best input from people for how they want their community to be planned, but also, how do I want to phrase this? What strategies are you using that have been most effective in implementing plans that deal with these newfound risks?
Well, one thing that I think we've done that's maybe unique in this example, this project I've been mentioning, working with the School of Planning, Design, and Construction, there have been faculty and graduate students that have developed graphics, visual designs of adaptations. So what does climate adaptation look like? You know, that is sort of a nebulous concept to some folks. I mean, as planners, we're kind of visual and, you know, think spatially, but that's not what the general public tends to do. And so, you know, faculty and students with the School of Planning, Design, and Construction, you know, have done some kind of before and after imaging. Like, let's look at a storm drain that might be, you know, your average open kind of ditch that might be the source of some of these nutrients coming into a lake. Well, how might you adapt that storm drain so that it is protecting public health? And so what might a green infrastructure application look like in that case? So we've had, you know, kind of the before and after image for examples like that. Similarly, you know, one of the concerns that's identified in sort of the north half of the state is disease from vectors, like ticks and the, you know, that might carry Lyme disease. And
yeah,
so
I was going to ask about invasive species because I know that those are another threat that's going to come from climate change as well in Michigan, right?
Yeah, I mean, the expansion of invasives is something folks are concerned about. You know, the tick that carries Lyme disease and not as an invasive species, but it's getting more endemic throughout the state in counties that have not seen the presence of Lyme disease. There are new reports and increasing numbers of reports. And so what is an adaptation to try to disrupt the climate health pathway for Lyme disease look like? You know, that's a stretch for folks. Well, as it turns out, it might be how you manage vegetation in and around your home, or how you educate the public about the use of trails and recreation spaces. It could be signage that makes this message known. It could be manicuring, you know, bushes and vegetation along pathways, keeping it lower and trimmed and off to the sides. And so this all makes this more realistic and understandable, I think, to the general public. So that's one thing I think planners could do on this is try to make it some of the solutions more visual and relatable to the average person.
Mary. Okay. We're going to wrap it up, but real quick, I just want, assuming that most people who are listening to this are planners and want to use MSU Extension as a resource, how should they go about doing that?
Well, I think our latest website URL, you can track down information at msue.msu.edu. And beyond that, we have a page dedicated to land use resources. And so you can get to a community dedicated page. And then deeper than that, planning would be one of the sub pages. And Mary is the keeper of many land use publications that have been developed over the years from folks that have been around longer than her and I. And so we've got a whole cadre of resources and information for people.
All right, great. So Mary Riley and Brad Newman from MSU Extension, thank you so much. And Mary's going to add
something else.
You're welcome,
Zach.
Yeah, okay.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for being here. We'll end it there.